Thank you from the beginning that you agreed to communicate with us and to join us. And we tried it a bit earlier, but we are now really, really happy, obviously, that you are really with us.
Thank you so much, Nico. You've been very patient, but I was going through, it was just a difficult time, and I was really thinking in my head about so many things. So I think five, six months or so, I dialed down a little in life, but I think I've bounced back. Yeah.
I think there are in life, there are these episodes. Everyone understands. I'm in absolutely no problem. Should we just start that you like introduce yourself a bit, tell us a bit where you come from, what's your background, and how you ended up here in hematology and oncology?
So I'm Nikita Mehra, and I come from Chennai, which was formerly called Madras in South India. And I've essentially, I completed my training in medical oncology, which includes hemato-oncology in 2017. And I passed out of the Adyar Cancer Institute, where I continue to work. I presently work as an associate professor with the Department of Medical Oncology. And my clinical responsibilities essentially include adult hemato-oncology and adult management of adult bone and soft tissue sarcomas. Additionally, I'm very interested in supportive care in oncology and cost-effectiveness of anti-cancer therapy. So essentially in 2018, I joined the Department of Molecular Oncology. So I spend half my academic time in the Department of Molecular Oncology at the Institute, at Adyar Cancer Institute. And I am pursuing a PhD in molecular oncology. So my work over there, the project is one on epigenetics in multiple myeloma and its precursor conditions. So yes, I am pursuing a career as a clinician scientist.
And did you always intend to do a bit of research, or was it just something that you were interested in and the opportunity came up?
So I think the interest really began in 2010. I did a brief clerkship for about 2 months at Beth Israel in Boston. And over there, what I did see was, I mean, I did a month's training in a clerkship in hematology. And really what I saw was all these clinicians were very, very busy. They'd want to finish their work. They'd want to wrap up the day by 12 or 1. And they'd always say, I have to go and work in the lab now. So I was very intrigued. I didn't have a lot of time to go and see what they were really doing in the lab. But ever since, I really knew that's what I wanted to do. And at the Adyar Cancer Institute, I'm very fortunate to be mentored by my guide, who is a clinician scientist. He is a medical oncologist. He completed his training even before 1990. And then went on to do a PhD from London in molecular oncology. So he's essentially set the framework, the structure for clinician scientists to be able to pursue their dreams. So it was very I completed I think when I finished in 2017, I completed my what we call a DM medical oncology. There are various training programs in India. One of them is a DM program, which is a 3-year program. So I completed it in 2017. I took a year to kind of figure what I really wanted to do, what I was interested in. And to be honest, I wanted to talk to my mentor, to Dr. Rajkumar, but I knew I would fumble. So I said, okay, let's wait for an entire year and then go and talk. There's been no looking back after my first conversation with Dr. Rajkumar.
And how did you get into hematology oncology? Was that also influenced by people or by experiences with patients during med school, or what was the reason?
So again, so in the at the institute during our training, what we have is we're assigned mentors, or maybe it's the other way around. The mentors are assigned mentees. So my mentor does a lot of work in hematological cancers. The work that I did during my training was all on chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting. But a little later, there was some work in multiple myeloma we did. And there was a very nice conference that I had the privilege to attend in 2016. A lot of the international myeloma experts were there. So again, my interest in myeloma really began through these various conferences, through interactions, and stayed on.
And how is your time split then between the clinical and the research? How does that work at the moment?
So again, my mentor, Dr. Rajkumar, under whom I'm pursuing the PhD, was very clear. And he said, if you're serious about a career as a clinician scientist, you have to dedicate, you need protected research time. So of course, there were administrative clearances that I had to go through. And I spend the first 3 days, that is Monday to Wednesday, doing my clinical work. And Thursday to Saturday is spent in the lab. But of course, it's easier said than done. It does not work that way. On the clinical days, when I'm done with my work, I sit in the lab. So I continue work in the lab. And again, from Thursday to Saturday, it's not as if I can only continue doing my lab work. There is, of course, clinical work, this patient work, and that continues as well. But there's a very, very understanding system and understanding structure. And one really puts their faith in you and knows you're going to sort of try and manage the two as well as you can.
Yeah, that was what I was going to say to you, that it sounds really warm, a really warm atmosphere. You have a mentor who tells you what to do or what not to do. And that's sometimes even more important, that people say, okay, if you want to do that, you cannot do the rest. That sounds really, really, really nice, a really nice place.
I think it's beautiful to have a mentor who can give you so much time and who can really... who can explain things to you and talk about experiences, but also at the end of it all, allows you to give your independent opinion. And one is, that independence is very, very important, which, yes, I am lucky to have, and I acknowledge it always.
And what is what are you currently focused on? What are you currently working on?
So at the moment, like I said, I have a grant from the Department of Science and Technology, Government of India, which is for the epigenetics project in myeloma. And this is a collaborative project with another very prestigious institute, the Christian Medical College, Vellore, with the Department of Hematology. Additionally, my project was initially rejected by the committee, and I had the opportunity to visit Mayo Clinic at Minnesota in 2019, where I spent about 5 days in clinic with both Dr. Shaji Kumar and Dr. Vincent Rajkumar. So over there, I really saw that, so I was very excited about MALDI turf analysis for M protein. And it was at the back of my mind that we did have the equipment in the Department of Molecular Oncology. I could not visit the Mollita of the mass spectrometry facility in at Mayo Clinic. But when I came back, I did not have a project on hand. There was a rejection. I was reapplying. And at this during this time, I spoke to my mentor and I said I wanted to. I asked if it was okay to work to do some work on mass spectrometry. So we essentially what we started out. I mean, I won't go into those details, but so there is work on MALDI-TOF for M protein analysis that goes on that we are presently running on research mode. But it's beautiful because you know, you have a lot of patients who cannot afford serum free light chain and serum immunofixation electrophoresis. And these are reports that one cannot generate because they're all run on research mode, but at least there's valuable information in terms of the M protein being present and so on and so forth. Besides that, there is some really exciting work that went on for a decade in the Department of Molecular Oncology. There was some bench work where they studied the effect of troglitazone and pioglitazone in osteosarcoma cell lines. So we were essentially ready to cell lines and then mice studies. So we were ready to do a bench to bedside project. And I lead two of the clinical trials. I mean, one is a pilot study on relapsed and refractory osteosarcoma, where we're looking at the effect of pioglitazone. And the other is a multi-center collaborative phase two clinical trial, where we're really looking at the effect of pioglitazone in osteosarcoma in a randomized study for patients with newly diagnosed osteosarcoma. Besides that, there's some really exciting work that's going on in the lab. There are several projects that that are led by Dr. Rajkumar himself. So his focus is on solid malignancies and not hematology. There's some very exciting work that's going on dendritic cell vaccines, where they've completed a phase one study on therapeutic dendritic cell vaccines for patients with locally advanced cervical cancer. The phase two study for cervical cancer is ongoing. And there is a new project for which a grant was approved for ovarian cancer. So I'm associated with the ovarian cancer project with regards to dendritic cell vaccine. Besides that, there are many, lot of other projects that are ongoing in the lab that I get to. I may not be directly associated with them, but there's always crosstalk. There's this very exciting discussion because everyone else in the lab, they're all scientists. So it's very exciting to learn different things from them, and it's exciting to also share the information that I can from the clinical side. Yes.
So with all this translational work that you're involved in, what do you kind of feel are the biggest challenges with trying to bring things from the lab into clinical practice to the bedside? Are there any particular barriers that?
So the challenges really are manpower. I mean, of course, we are a country with several constraints, and with the kind of patient load that one has, it's really going to be, it will always be difficult to justify a lot of manpower. So that is an issue that one faces across the country, and is not restricted to any one institute or a center. Additionally, funding opportunities are there, but again, you know, how long does it take for you to be able to get those funds in order to really start the project? That can also be a challenge. But you know, I really think it's all beautiful to pursue a career as a clinician scientist, but I completely understand that this is a privilege.
How does it work in your department, let's say, because we talked 2 weeks or 3 weeks ago to Neha Desai, also from India. And there we just highlighted, and we also want this to highlight to you, that I am quite fascinated of how little I know about India and how it's working and how big it is.
You should visit India very soon.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Clay and I try to develop like a travel plan through India.
Definitely.
But how does it work in your department? Are you completely state funded, or do you need to apply for grants even to stay at work, to do your research? Is your hospital like state funded, or is it private funded? How does that work? Is that a tough situation, or are you relaxed with the finances at the moment?
So one needs to find funding for projects that we drive in the Department of Molecular Oncology, and all the ongoing projects have funding from various funding agencies, mostly from the government of India, in the department.
Mm-hmm. And the patients who are, for example, who are on the trials for some of the bench to bedside work you're doing, do they come from all over India, or is it just a few centers that are able to? How does that work?
So for clinical trials that we run in the department, patients do come from, they're mostly patients who are treated at Adyar Cancer Institute. So they're all, they live close to the center or they're mostly within the state or from neighboring states. We don't get a lot of patients from many far off states. I mean, that's usually an exception. It isn't the rule, because there are, of course, several. There are many centers across the country now. Earlier, that wasn't the case, but now, of course, things are changing. And I think with the COVID pandemic, one has seen, even patients want to seek options closer to their home place. And that really has changed everywhere.
That would get us to the next question. What was your experience with the COVID pandemic, and how did you experience it? What did you think is the most, like, the biggest impact that maybe changed practice? Or
I think it was obviously a very difficult time for everyone across the world, and India was not unique, but you know, the interactions with patients and their caregivers and the issues they were facing, one has always interacted, but you know, with the lockdowns and they were unable to make it to nearby centers for simple blood investigations or to refill their medication. I mean, that was very, very painful. And patients having to spend a lot of money because public transport wasn't available, they would have to, not work they would have to let go of work in order to come to the institute. And they were very, very painful discussions. And this really happened during the first wave. Again, the state of Tamil Nadu has a robust public health system. So there are, even in the most remote parts of Tamil Nadu, which is where Chennai is located, you do have very nice healthcare systems. So in terms of COVID, I mean, if they developed an infection, so they were very well looked after in terms of the infection. But the fact that they could not come and get their medication, that was very, very difficult. Having said that, we started developing, one was telemedicine or interactions. One became very comfortable with interactions over the phone, video calls, That was something that was sort of almost unheard of earlier. And, you know, it's quite amazing. A lot of the patients are treated for free, but they have access to emails. And so many of my patients would, they have my email address, and their caregivers, their children would send out emails saying, okay, here are the reports. What do you want us to do? Especially people also, including people from other states. So I became very comfortable with these managing patients via phone and email or video calls through the pandemic.
And for the lab and the lab research side of your work, was that put on hold or anything? Certainly, I think here in the UK, I know lots of people who were doing PhDs and stuff, which were just put on hold as they had to go back and work in the clinical setting when the pandemic was at its peak. Did that happen to you at all? Or?
So the MALDI-TOF M-protein analysis work began in October, November of 2019. And we found some really exciting things. We identified a new process to really identify the M-protein by MALDI-TOF. So we were able to file a patent very quickly in March 2020. And this was right before the nationwide lockdown. So of course, we had to stop doing all our work when the nationwide lockdown began. We were unsure of what was going to happen to samples. How is this virus going to spread? So of course, everyone was taking a break from lab work, and patients were coming in. So there was obviously more work on the clinical side. Having said that, I did make a reference to the project that I was working on, which was the MALDI-TOF for M-protein analysis work. Thankfully enough, we were able to do some exciting things. We identified some exciting alternate processes in order to identify this M-protein. And when the lockdown really happened, it was at the same time when I could sit down and kind of work on my manuscript. But what really happened was the initial submissions, the reviewers, editors were very, very kind, and they said, we cannot find reviewers. We found reviewer one, but we don't have reviewer two. And these were very, very, they were nice international journals, but really nice editors. So of course, there were several rejections that one had to face as a result. But it's all good because, you know, they tell you to, they ask you for additional experiments. And as time goes, your sample size keeps increasing, or you're learning from all these lovely reviewers. Sometimes they can be harsh, but it's okay. I think one has to look at the bigger picture, which was, which I think all worked out fine. Yeah. So yes, we took a break for some time from lab work until one understood that it was safe to go back to work. It was safe to handle samples. And then we really bounced back to whatever we were doing.
What I noticed here in Germany, and this brings us maybe back one step, what you said about the COVID pandemic is that we here in Germany, we started to talk about, okay, can we treat these patients? Are these like serious patients we need to treat with chemotherapy, stem cell transplant, whatever? But what you said was quite intriguing to me, because I also experienced that with friends, that other questions, and that brings us to your supportive care and supportive care engagement, is that these kind of treatments or conditions that people and patients really suffer from, let's say nausea, that this was kind of, it's an adverse event, but it's not serious right now. Let's keep these patients out of the hospital. And this brings us to the question, okay, what should we refine supportive care? I know there is a lot of development now going on. People talk differently about what it means to receive chemo and to suffer from neuropathy, et cetera. But what brought you into this kind of research stream? Because you said you approached supportive care really early on in your career. And when I look at my department, no one from my trainee colleagues really discusses adverse events. Yeah, they exist. You learn them from your book. And then you just says, yeah, this, let's say from this immunosuppressant, this is headache. Yeah, it's an adverse event. We expected that. But what brought you to this research, and what do you think about it? Should we change something, or how do you approach this in India?
What got me really interested was, again, my mentor during my training. His name is Dr. Prashant Ganeshan. And we started, the publication had just come out on olanzapine, palmesetron, and dexamethasone for highly emetogenic chemotherapy. I think a phase 2 study was out by Navari. He's done some really nice work, and I think he's from Indiana University in the US. So we were talking about really comparing the aprepitant-based regimens to olanzapine. We were wary of the olanzapine issues. I mean, drowsiness, one was worried about hyperglycemia and so many other concerns. But it was really exciting for us because the cost, I mean, it was, there's no comparison, because we're talking about something that's aprepitant is the three capsule course is almost 10 times higher than the cost of olanzapine. So we decided to really explore this area, and they were not clinical trials, because we were honestly worried about toxicities and everything. So what we essentially did was we to patients who failed aprepitant in the first cycle, that is if they had a grade 3 CINV or more, chemo-induced nausea and vomiting, or if patients had a grade 3 or above chemo-induced nausea and vomiting, we switched from aprepitant to olanzapine. And this was a very nice study we did across various highly emetogenic chemotherapy regimens, and mostly in solid cancers. And we found that olanzapine was safe. It was very, very inexpensive, and it worked wonders on patients who failed aprepitant. And this was very exciting, because we have a very nice division of psycho-oncology at the institute. So this was a project that we sort of drove together, and we were in touch with patients all the time, because we were really, really worried about the most minor issue if they did develop from olanzapine. We went on to publish a study, and we did another study on giving a shorter course of olanzapine for just 2 days at half the dose, which was 5 milligram, to patients who received a weekly cisplatin. So of course we have a very high burden of cervical cancer in India, and oftentimes patients are on concurrent chemotherapy with that is cisplatin, which is about 40 milligrams per meter square, along with radiotherapy, pelvic radiotherapy. So again, we went on to publish that study as well. But I think that was really why I became very, very interested in supportive care. There is another translational research project that we're trying to drive. I think it's very, very important, because, you know, we don't have access to all these newer drugs that's available in the West. We know it's going to take a very, very long time for these drugs to come to India. And even if they do, 1%, even less than 1% is going to be able to access it. So I truly believe we will be able to improve patient outcomes by just improving our supportive care measures. And, you know, in terms of improving, you improve their quality of life, patients come back for treatment, they trust you, or simple things like vaccinating patients for multiple myeloma, the quadrivalent influenza and the pneumococcal vaccine. You know, the real challenge here is we don't have large research teams data entry officers or operators. So one really drives a lot of things on their own. And I really look forward to systems changing. It will be very difficult, but it is possible. I think if where there is a will, there is a way. But lots of work is done, and honestly, it's very difficult to write up many things, or to sometimes even submit these manuscripts to get them published, because it takes away from a lot of your clinical or your lab research time, and your lab research time is limited in the sense that, you know, you have a grant, you've got timelines, and you really cannot goof around there. Mm-hmm. And on the clinical work, this is something I often tell people. Sometimes, it's beautiful to publish, but sometimes you're turning a blind eye to social issues. And you really ask yourself, now, it's very, very important to publish, and in reputed peer-reviewed journals, there's absolutely no questions asked. But you also have to address issues that you may face, or that your patients face, and you really have two ways to look at it, right? You know, I mean, you either just ignore it and say, you know, it's fine, I need to do my thing, or you say, okay, let's see how we can work this out, and that takes away from some of your research time. But no regrets, no, absolutely. One needs to find the right balance. But what drives you to work every day is that purpose. And as long as you feel like you've done something meaningful at the end of the day, you're happy.
So let me just ask you a quick question, because you just mentioned it, but maybe we could fix it, because Neha also said this. So it in your case, is this also the case that you have a big problem of data documentation? Is that correct? So you don't have like data managers or...
So we do have. We absolutely have. And I can talk about... Sorry, I'll let you finish.
No, just interrupt me and go on.
So I think, in 2018, the Hematology Cancer Consortium was really put together. And this was an initiative by two of my mentors. One is Dr. Vikram Matthews, who's from the Christian Medical College of Vellore, is a hematologist and a professor with the Department of Hematology, and Dr. Manju Sengal, who's a professor of medical oncology at the Tata Memorial in Mumbai. And they really set out to bring various institutions and various centers treating patients with hematological malignancies together. Wonderful, you really need a vision to do something like that, and of course they do. I've been able to observe from afar how things go on, or all of us get to watch how these processes were put in place, because our institute is also a member of the Hematology Cancer Consortium. So through the consortium, there are various research activities going on, which includes being provided with data entry operators. And it's a beautiful system because you know you're capturing everything at real time. Again, there is an organization that has provided funds, so there are timelines that one needs to meet with. So there is a beautiful system in place, and one has had the chance to kind of learn to work with data entry operators for hematological malignancies. We have one at the institute, and it's very exciting because they have exciting questions, they have exciting ideas on how they're going to abstract data, debriefing sessions. So that system, the Hematology Cancer Consortium, is very, very inspiring for me. There are registries that they that are ongoing in leukemias and lymphomas, and lots of collaborative projects have come out. There are two publications out, one on ALL, on data from across the country, and everyone, every center, every state is so different than the other. And it's beautiful for everyone to have come together. There was a COVID registry study that was published, and the numbers were, of course, very, very large. So this really, it sort of helps you understand how you're going to go about in other spheres. I mean, I work in bone and soft tissue sarcomas as well. And there's a lot of learning from something like this. So yes, I mean, there are data entry operators, there are systems in place, but it's going to be very difficult because of the patient load to kind of match up. I'm sure we will be there. More projects, more funding, more manpower, it's all possible, but everything together. I mean, all of us need to come together for it. One or two cannot drive it.
When you reflect on your career, what went well?
What is there anything what you wish for? Yeah.
So I think what I always tell the trainees is, I mean, you have, or in our institute, it is a three-year program. Don't take any immediate decision, because what you might want 1 year from now will be very different from what you want right now. So give yourself that time. And I think it's very important. And this is not for trainees from within the institute. I think once they finished, they should seek opportunities in institutes that that have opportunities available. Because research is not something that you're only going to drive within large institutes treating large numbers. I think it's very important to pursue research wherever you are, even if it is a private hospital, even if it is a rural cancer center. But the methodologies, that streamlining, you need to really meet the right people or seek the right mentors for things like that. Structured research training is certainly lacking in several places. So I think it's very important. It's never too late to learn, but yes, seek opportunities, and research is very, very exciting. It's not going to be possible to emulate the research that is going on in high income countries. Sometimes yes, but oftentimes not. You're going to have to develop local solutions. For that, you really need to learn to ask the right questions and address them systematically.
Mm. And I really also like your that you highlight that it's, if you work in a single center that has a large number of patients, you can do something, but you only can do really like meaningful things if you collaborate with others and see how others work. And I think there is a lot of potential in India to do that, as you highlighted with your cancer consortium. I think this is a huge opportunity to make. I mean, what you just said is this: how many patients do you have, or potential patients, let's say? There may be even patients you don't know about. I mean, that's huge. And I think that's, we should, yeah, all see that and support you to do your own things and your own like research to help your people.
But the fact is, yes, collaboration means you find solutions quicker. And really with the Hematology Cancer Consortium, one has seen how clinical trials are proposed, accepted, are run. You see them through completion, and lots of exciting things going on over there. So in Tamil Nadu, we have the CMCHIS scheme, which is basically the Chief Minister's comprehensive health insurance scheme. And it's very interesting. We are very privileged in that state. So the scheme is very interesting, and we're very, very grateful to the ones that really put together the scheme and see it smoothly running. So if you have multiple myeloma, for instance, we're funded for patients who are on CMCHIS, who have the CMCHIS card, VTD, VRD, CyBorD, pomalidomide-based regimens, melphalan-based regimens, which actually work very well, oral melphalan, bendamustine, everything is funded through the scheme. Of course, you have the institute also pitching in, because patients, you know, there is supportive care and things like that. But sometimes you might not be able to. I mean, the institute also subsidizes in order to make these schemes possible. But another very interesting fact is all the transplants for multiple myeloma. The autologous stem cell transplants for patients who are funded through the CMCHIS get the funding for it. So it's in that sense, it's beautiful to run these multiple myeloma programs, especially for patients who have the funding. You can sleep more, you can worry less, because you know you have a scheme looking after. And again, the same scheme also looks after patients requiring allogeneic stem cell transplants. I mean, they could be matched sibling donors, they could be matched unrelated donors, haplo-identical transplants. So it's beautiful to work in a healthcare system, to work in a state that is very serious about healthcare, that is very serious about providing what is essential for patients when they require it.
Yeah, I think we definitely need to work out a travel plan, Claire.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Nico and Claire, for having me on your podcast. It was an absolute privilege and honor to be here, to be able to share my thoughts, to get your opinions and suggestions.
No, it's, well, I cannot learn enough about India, about other countries, because it's so shameful how little I know. And I think Claire agrees with me on that.
Well, the same is true for your country. We don't know much.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think we can just learn from one another, and especially in myeloma, I think Europe and Western, let's say Western countries, whatever that means on a planet, but we can learn more from you, I think, than maybe the other way around, or from different things, because in my personal opinion that our system, our healthcare system, will crash at some point if we keep on trying to develop these new kind of treatments and give them to everyone. I think the same is true for UK, I Absolutely. Presume. And yeah. For CAR T cells, this is potentially now the turning point we need to recognize. And in that regard, I think we just need to learn from you guys and how you work. And I think that's why collaboration and understanding is so important.
I think the admiration is mutual.
The admiration is mutual.
The admiration is mutual. Yeah. And there's a lot we learn from you as well.
Perfect.
Thank you very much for your time. Have a good weekend.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks. And have a good night. So sorry.
Yeah.
Thank you. It's not late at all. Thanks a lot.